Well, Mr. Desalanis, thank you so much for agreeing to do the interview. We'd like to start by, if you wouldn't mind telling me your full name and when you were born.
Okay, I'm Jim Desalanis. I was born in 1938 in Ancon Canal Zone in Gorgas Hospital.
Okay, and I understand that your family has a long history in Panama.
All four of my grandparents went down there during the construction of the canal. And my grandfather, with the same name that I have, was killed on the Gatun locks in 1911. He was electrocuted, and he was electrocuted 3 months before my dad was born.
Wow.
So my grandmother took his body back to the States and buried him, and she returned to the canal zone and went back to the job she had there.
Mm-hmm. What was her job?
She was a telephone operator.
Uh-huh.
Her father, she was from Lafayette, Indiana, and her father was a major in the Civil War, and she had a family friend who was going down there to work, and she was just out of school, and she took a trip with him down there and ended up taking a job when she was there, and then she met my grandfather. And they got married, then he got killed.
Mm.
So that's that part of the history. My other grandfather graduated from college in Missouri and went to work in Washington, D.C., and he was an accountant, and he was recruited to come to Panama to work. So then he returned to the United States, got married, and took my grandmother on that side down to Panama. And so my mother was born in the canal zone. Well, I'm wrong on that. My mother was born in Washington, D.C.,
okay.
But her mother was on the ship to go to Panama and started having labor pains, and they rushed her back to Washington, D.C., and she gave birth to my mother, and then my grandfather came back and got her and took her back to Panama with the new baby. So that's the grandparent side of the program.
Okay. So Panama runs deep in your family's history.
Oh, absolutely.
Wow. What were your earliest memories growing up?
Well, I was born in 38, and many of the old houses were still in existence. And it was just, we lived in these old wooden houses. In fact, I counted the other day that I had lived in 23 different houses in the old canal zone. I lived in 9 different houses when I was a boy growing up, and then when I was employed, I did the balance. I did 14 houses during my period of employment.
Wow.
So, anyway, the old houses, I'll tell you one story that's very interesting. They all had scuttle holes on them. These wooden, big tropical wooden houses had scuttle holes at the sides of the house, and people would take a hose and wash their house out and push all the water out through the scuttle holes. Those tropical houses were something else. And you know, everybody had mango trees around their houses. They all had tin roofs on them, except those that, you know, had the tile roofs. But it just, I can just think back about the hard rains and the sound from those old tin roofs, no air conditioning.
Yeah.
So it was, and the bugs, the roaches were something else in those days. Every house had roaches. No rats, but roaches.
Okay. Do you remember, or maybe you weren't quite old enough to remember World War II?
I remember it well. My mother was a Red Cross worker, and she would take me. She worked on the docks handing out coffee to the sailors that were coming through on the ships coming back from the Pacific. And I was just a little fellow, and she'd take me down to the docks with her. And I had the biggest collection of sailor hats you ever saw, because all these sailors that were coming from the Pacific going back up to the East Coast would give me a sailor hat.
Wow,
it was quite a collection. So But I also remember all the activity there for World War II, even though I was, I was like 4, 5, 6 years old, and it was, my dad worked 7 days a week. He worked all the time. He ran the what they called Section I, which was the storehouse operation for the Panama Canal, and they were moving millions of board feet of lumber through there all the time that was being used in for different projects and what have you. But it was an exciting time. And one of my best stories is at the end of World War II, the military guys used to play softball games with the Canal Zone people. And, you know, there'd be big crowds at these softball games. And I was at this softball game in a little town site of Diablo. And I went home for some reason. Our house was about 2 blocks away. And while I was home, the radio was on and they announced that Japan had surrendered and the war was over in the Pacific. And my little legs started running. I ran back to the ballpark and I'm telling all these people, World War II is over. Japan has surrendered. And they were saying, what are you talking about, little kid? You don't even, you know. And then the sirens, they had sirens and all the towns had sirens that would warn people if there's any problems. But the sirens came on and the announcement was made that Japan had surrendered.
Wow.
So
how did people react?
Oh, it was bedlam. I mean, as a little kid, I can remember. Everybody was yelling and screaming and running around, hugging each other. And these were civilian teams playing. It was a Navy team that they were playing at the time. And it was really, really exciting. But, you know, I ended up being the superintendent of housing for the Panama Canal. And I was involved in tearing down many of the old houses and all that. And that was an emotional thing for me. But, and you know, back in the 30s and 40s, we were still living in the houses on the furniture that they had brought down in the construction of the canal, because they would employ people from the States and bring them down and give them a house to live in and give them furniture to live on. So the Panama Canal had these big warehouses full of furniture to be able to furnish houses for people. Mm-hmm. And then later on, they phased that program out and people bought their own furniture. And they bought it from the commissaries that were owned by the canal. But one of the projects I had working for the housing branch was to get rid of all that furniture. And it was all in a big, huge warehouse. The warehouse must have been 2 blocks long. And it was just full of tens of thousands of pieces of furniture. And I was charged with recording it all. And we were giving it to orphanages in Panama. Oh, and okay. There was a big vacant lot nearby the warehouses. And I was having the men carry all this furniture out. And I put the beds in one place and the chairs in another. And you know, separating it all out. And I remember cars stopping along the highway and people running up. Could I buy some of that? Could I buy some? I mean, it was all wooden furniture. That would, you know, it was good wood.
Yeah.
But I was told you can't get rid of any of these things. These are going to the orphanages in Panama. So the canal turned over, like I say, tens of thousands of pieces of furniture to these orphanages.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm. So you went, when World War II ended, you were about 7 or 8.
Right.
And can you talk about your high school experience and where you went to high school?
I went to Balboa High School, and I graduated in 1956. And it was a typical 1950s high school. In fact, I've always felt like the people that lived in the Canal Zone were more like Americans than Americans. We were all very patriotic people, and I think most of us really knew more about American history than kids back in the United States.
What made the difference? What made that so?
I don't know. It was when you live out of the country, it's it's a different environment. You know, it's a, you know, well, that's America. We would go back to the United States. All the employees of the canal would go back every 2 years on vacation, and the canal operated three ships that you would travel back and forth the United States on the ships, and they would go to New York Harbor when I was a boy growing up. They changed later on and went out to New Orleans, but during the time I was growing up, we'd go into New York. So I made a number of round trips from Panama to New York and back. And I can remember in the late 1940s, we got on the ship in New York City and were supposed to sail and come back. And they had the biggest labor strike they've ever had on the docks of New York. And we spent 2 weeks living on the ship there, tied up to the dock. Uh-huh. And I can remember with my little buddies, we would hang around the dock, and all these longshoremen were gathered, the unions gathered them all together. Uh-huh. They were running around with clubs, yelling and screaming. It was bedlam.
Wow. Jeez.
But for a little fellow, it was interesting going through that.
Yeah.
And you know, if you study American, well, union history, you look back and see that it's considered one of the biggest strikes of all time in America.
Okay.
Yeah. It closed down the Port of New York.
Shut down the Port of New York.
Yeah. Wow.
Now, you mentioned earlier, Mr. Dislan, is the sense that in the canal zone, it was more, you were kind of more American. That was really something emphasized. Was that something emphasized in the schools, like in the books or the curriculum or the teachers or the...
I think so. I think we were more aware of being Americans. Like 4th of July was like the biggest celebration of the year in the Canal Zone. Hmm. I mean, it was the biggest day of the year. There was fairs and athletic events. It was an amazing day. Every little kid lived for the 4th of July celebration.
Mm-hmm. Did you do fireworks?
We could go into Panama City. See, the Canal Zone was separate and operated under separate laws. Now, you couldn't sell fireworks in the Canal Zone, but all we had to do was step over into Panama City and we could buy anything we wanted. And and every little kid had loads of firecrackers and little bombs and everything else. Uh-huh. And you just can't imagine all thousands of kids running around with all these firecrackers and big firecrackers, and it was something else.
Okay, wow. Well, you mentioned, you know, going to the U.S. Periodically. What types of connections did your family have to family and friends in the U.S. in the 50s?
Well, mainly people went back to visit where their parents may have come from. Now, in my case, my grandparents, my grandmother retired back to Lafayette, Indiana, and we'd go to Lafayette. And my mother's father retired to California, so we'd go out to California. Now, my mother's mother died in the Canal Zone, and my father's father was killed down there in 1911. So every year we'd go back and go visit Grandma in Lafayette and Grandpa out in California, and my mother's sister lived out in California, so we would visit with her. But as a boy, I did at least three round trips from New York to California and back.
Wow. What were the differences that you saw between, like, California, New York, and Panama?
Well, in our mind, and I don't know where this came from, but in our mind, everything back in the United States was really better. And, all the food was imported into the Canal Zone. Most of the food. At one time, the canal had its own dairy. It had everything. The canal was self-sustaining. But for some reason, there was an attitude that the the meat tastes better back in the United States, and the butter tasted better, and the milk tasted better. Uh-huh. And you'd want to go get a milkshake and things like that. We're back in America now, you know. That was exciting. We're back in America. But it was a perception more than the truth, you know.
Yeah.
But like I say, most of us just, that was America, and we lived in the Canal Zone, and we knew that we were Americans, and we were living out of the, you know,
yeah.
We were living in another country, so to speak. Well, it was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Some people I've talked to who grew up in the Canal Zone have said that they, you know, and every experience is subjective, of course, but some folks have said, well, people were taught better manners in the Canal Zone compared to, say, American kids in the States. Does that ring true to you, or is that kind of...
Yes, it does. It's that... I don't know. It's, I don't know how to explain it. It was just... You were expected to be a representative of America, you know, and I think the Americans down there tried to represent America, the best of America, in that respect. You follow me? Mm-hmm. There's always been a stigma between the Americans and the Panamanians, but there was two classes of people in Panama, basically, when I grew up. Mm-hmm. There was the working class, and then there was the upper Panamanian class. And most of them had been educated in the United States. They went to all the best colleges. They all had plenty of money. So it was basically a class system. Mm-hmm. So now, and I'm going to tell you something about the housing aspect of it that I don't know if you've heard it in any other interviews, but if an American man married a Panamanian girl, they were told they had to live in the town of Ancon, which was right on the border. A lot of people don't know this, but remember, I go back many, many years.
Yeah.
But so there are many, many of my friends that came from mixed marriages, and they were half Panamanian and half American, but they grew up in a way they were stigmatized. Hmm. And a lot of them had a chip on their shoulder about the way they were treated. Their father was an American, their mother was a Panamanian. Mm-hmm. And very few of the American men, now remember, a majority of the people working in the canal were working class Americans. They were tradesmen, they were electricians, they were plumbers and all that. And most of those men that married Panamanians from the non-rich class of people.
Okay.
You know, a lot of guys, a lot of the men married girls from the interior of Panama. Mm-hmm. These girls had no education. So there was always that stigma. But I'll tell you, most of these guys that I grew up with that were half Panamanian, half American, did well in school. They went on to college. They became doctors and lawyers. They were terrific people. Most of them were good athletes, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I remember about that part of living in the Canal Zone.
Okay. And along those same lines, Mr. Deslandes, do you remember what relations were like in kind of in general between people who lived in the zone and kind of the broader society?
It was like many, many other things. There were Americans there that never left the Canal Zone, and then there were Americans that had many friends in Panama. I was lucky. My father had been a very good athlete down there, and he had many Panamanian friends. And so I grew up knowing both, you know, I knew both sides.
Yeah.
I was a golfer. I spent a lot of time playing golf. And I played golf was friends with a couple of the presidents of Panama and all that. But I have many friends who really, they were quite active in Panama society. Mm-hmm. But there were some Americans that were of the type that you might call the ugly Americans. But that's, I don't know how to phrase it, but you have that everywhere you go, yeah. You know. There's prejudiced people on both sides. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the Panamanian people, from the wealthy side, of, they wouldn't think of one of their children getting married to an American because they looked at most of the Americans as the laboring class. The you know, they saw them as plumbers and electricians, and they were from high society in Panama. Right. They didn't want their kids marrying those working class Americans. You know, so there it went both ways.
Speaking of occupation, now when you were in high school, you went to Balboa High School.
Right.
Were you in high school, were you thinking about a career or your future? Or were you aspirations or?
Well, I wanted to be a golf pro. Mm-hmm. I didn't work real hard in high school, so I got myself drafted right out of high school.
Wow. What year was that?
1956. And I got very lucky. I got selected to be the assistant to the golf pro at the Officers Golf Club at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. So I spent 2 years in a job that I dreamed of. In fact, I was in the 82nd Airborne, signed to the 82nd Airborne Division after I got out of basic training. And I wasn't there a week, and I was going through pre-airborne training. And I got this call to report to Maine Post, to the golf pro. He wanted to interview me. He'd gotten my name, and he said, I want you to come to work for me. And he had paperwork sent up to have me transferred from the 82nd down to his outfit down there at the golf club.
Wow.
And I went before the sergeant major of the 82nd Airborne Division, who had fought in World War II, and he had all these stars on his wings and all that. And I can remember standing in front of his desk. And this sergeant major said, "You're going to leave the airborne to go work at a golf club?" He said, "You're going to ruin the rest of your life." He said, "That's a terrible thing to do." My knees were knocking together because I was so excited. I'm getting my dream job now. I'm 18 years old and getting my dream job, and this guy's trying to talk me out of it.
Yeah.
And I can remember saying, no, Sergeant Major, this is what I want to do.
Wow.
Oh, golly. And then I had a general take a liking to me, and he had me tutored by a very brilliant young captain. And I took the West Point exam and got selected to go before a board to go to West Point. And there were two lieutenants on the board. And when I walked into this room, they spent a lot of time at the golf club, and they knew me well. I looked down at them, and they looked at me. And they tell me later, "You'd have never made it through West Point," so I didn't get selected. Oh, God.
So you were in the service from 56 to
58.
58, yes. Okay. And what came next?
Well, I went to Canal Zone Junior College, and at the same time, I opened a miniature golf course in Panama City.
Okay.
And I opened three or four different businesses. I had another miniature golf course up in the town of David in Panama, and had a small go-kart racetrack. Well, but I ended up going broke in business and going back to the United States.
Wow.
And then I returned to Panama in the early 60s and took a job as the assistant project manager on a project for the Army, building 500 houses at Fort Clayton and Fort Amador. Hmm. And but I had taken the examination to become a policeman in the Canal Zone. They weren't hiring many boys or many people that grew up in the Canal Zone. In fact, there was almost at that time, don't hire any Canal Zone kids. but
to work in the canal
zone. There was a few that got employed, but very few.
Oh.
And anyhow, I took the police exam and got 100 on it, and I had 5 points for being a veteran. And so I was at the top of the list, and the riots came in 64,
yeah.
And they started hiring policemen. I was at the top of the employment list, so I got a job as a police officer and worked 6 months and transferred into the housing branch and spent a career with housing. And my last job with the canal was chief of the community services division.
Hmm.
So I left Panama in 89. I got robbed. I got held up at gunpoint at Fort Amador.
Hmm.
And there's a long story behind that. But then several days later, I was playing golf at Amador with a fellow who helped save my life there, because these guys that held me up were what they call maleantes from Panama City. Mm-hmm. And one of them had a gun. And when these two fellows that I'm talking about came to help me, they fired the gun at them and left. And then 3 days later, I'm playing golf with these guys, and one of them gets into an argument on the first tee at the Amador Golf Club, and I went up there to help him, and the guy hit me, and I've never had anything like this happen on a golf course before. And it turned out one of these guys was a pilot for Noriega, and the other was a businessman that was in things with Noriega. They didn't know anything about golf. And I ended up having a fist fight with this guy, and he threatened to kill me and my family. And at that same week, these same guys with some other guys had burned down one of the yachts at the Amador Yacht Club that belonged to a Panamanian businessman, and killed the guy that was working on the boat. So I had enough. And I sent my wife and daughter back to the States, and I retired in 89 and left there.
Wow.
But it was an exciting, what was really bothering me is being in charge of all the housing and everything. At this point in 89, we were having about 5 or 6 houses broken into every night.
Mm-hmm.
These were not good times.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, I just was unhappy with the whole situation. I was unhappy with the treaty.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it was, they signed the right treaty. I mean, I wanted to see a treaty, but I didn't want to see the way they did it. And I decided to retire.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back to the United States. But as a side note to this, I was part of a group that was pushing to have a different type treaty written than was planned by the State Department. Mm-hmm. And the State Department recognized the effort that we were making, because we were getting a lot of attention in the TV in the United States. In fact, I got interviewed, was on NBC worldwide, a lot of different things like that happened. But I can still remember our whole group listening to these State Department. They came out to my house, and I had all my people in the house, and these guys were trying to convince us to not fight the treaty anymore. They said they were writing provisions in the treaty that would give us early retirement, and they were asking us right out in front, what would you like? What can we do for you to make this treaty palatable so you'll quit fighting this? And I can remember everybody in the room saying, we don't want you to give us anything. We don't want you to write this type of treaty, you know? This is not right to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it still came out the way it came out. But I ended up getting early retirement. I've had a wonderful life since 89. I've been retired 20-some years now. And I came back to the United States, became a PGA golf professional, and I've been the head professional at a couple of fine golf courses, and I've had a great life. But I still, down in my heart, just felt like the United States gave away more than they needed to.
Okay.
In fact, I was the guy who had to sign over all the houses to the government of Panama over because I was superintendent of housing at the time. Mm-hmm. And they had a ceremony where we signed over all these houses, and I represented the United States. And officially, when I signed that document, they became the owner of close to 5,000 houses in 21 town sites in the Canal Zone.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point on, we had to deal with Panamanian officials on everything we did in managing the houses from that point on out until it was all turned over. But these houses were given back to Panama little by little. It was an emotional experience.
Yeah. I like to get more of your thoughts about the treaty in a few minutes, but I also wanted to, you'd mentioned something that I've never heard anyone talk about in the interviews that we've done, the Canal Zone Junior College. Can you talk about that? Like what you studied, what it was like, the curriculum?
Well, it was very typical of junior colleges any place in the world. In fact, my brother was a professor there at the college.
Hmm.
He got his master's degree in the United States, and he ended up, I helped him get employed down there, but it was a very, very good school. In fact, many students did their 2 years there and went to universities back in the United States, the best universities, and did well. Joe Wood, who you've been dealing with here.
Yes, sir.
Joe Wood did 2 years at the Canal Zone College and graduated, and then went to University of Florida and got his degree.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe ended up being one of the top men with the Panama Canal. So my brother used to kid around. He said he was an accounting teacher and an economics teacher. And in fact, one of his students ended up going to Harvard, and he wrote him a letter. He said, "You are as good as any professor I had at Harvard." So that was quite a compliment to him.
Yeah.
But most of the professors there at the junior college had their master's and PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good school.
And then you, this is something that's been interesting to me also as you're talking. Where did you learn how to play golf? I mean, who taught you? Was it?
Well, there were a number of golf clubs in the Canal Zone in Panama. My grandfather was one of the original members of the Panama Golf Club. So my dad was a member of the Panama Golf Club. And every weekend, my dad and I would go out there. But also, there was a course called Fort Amador. It was a military course. And many of the zone people were a member of that golf club. The dues were like, when I was growing up, were like about $10 a month.
Mm.
And I worked there during 3 years of high school. I worked there on the weekends. I made $1 an hour. And golf has been a big part of my life. But many young men came out of Panama and went to college and played on golf teams back in the United States. And there's five or six of us ended up as PGA golf professionals. But in fact, I was on the first golf team that played in it was the National Junior Championship in the United States. It was run by the JCs.
Okay.
And in 1953, four of us, the first four guys who finished in this tournament, it was an all Caribbean tournament, and they called us the Latin American team. But I was on that team and went to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we stayed at the university there and played golf. One of the fellows was from Costa Rica, and I've watched him through the years. But and then several years later, I was 17. I made the I got to go to Georgia and play, and that was one of Jack Nicklaus's first tournaments. He was 3 years younger than me. And a story I love to tell, I was standing with some guys talking. We were the older guys there because you couldn't play after you got to be, I think it was 18. And somebody said, "You see that little fat guy over there? That's his name is Jack Nicklaus. He's from Ohio. That little fellow is probably going to be one of the greatest golfers in the world." And I remember somebody saying, "Oh, there's lots of guys like that around." And this fellow said, "No, there isn't. That's Jack Nicklaus. He's going to be something else." And Jack Nicklaus turned out to be the best golfer there's ever been, you know? So that's an interesting little story.
Yeah, that is. What were some of your other memorable experiences as a golf professional?
Well, I've made 16 hole-in-ones.
Wow. That's incredible.
But most of the golf courses in the Canal Zone have closed up because of the treaty. Now, there's a course. It's all Panama now, of course. Mm-hmm. It's called Summit. And I was president of Summit Golf Course at one time. But now Summit Golf Course is one of the finest golf courses in Latin America. Okay. The money, I think, was used to rehabilitate Summit and make it into what it is, I think, came from Colombia.
Oh, wow.
It was Colombian money. And I'm not going to say where Colombian money came from. But,
exactly, yeah. Wow. You mentioned there are a few of the other social upheavals, or the 64 riot. Now, you were...
In 64, I was the assistant project manager with a company called Jefferson Engineering. And we were building these houses for the Army. And my boss asked me to go play golf. It's the only time he'd ever done it. And we went over to a place called Rodman. And we were coming back through a street that runs between the Canal Zone and Panama, mm-hmm. because he was staying, he had a house with his family in Panama City, and I was running him home before I went to where I live. And within an hour after we passed this place is when the riots really erupted. We were there an hour before. Anyway, we were in his house. We were doing a barbecue there, and somebody had the radio on, and they said, "Hey, there's riots." And I had been through the 1959 riots and saw all that happened. I said, "Guys, we've got to get out of here." And, "Oh, no, we're going to stay here." I said, "I'm going to tell you, if this gets really bad," I said, "you're going to be hiding in your houses here." So I left. I got in my car, and I left. And I went through the back gate of Corundu and drove it back into Ancon Balboa area. And you could see, I mean, it was unbelievable. I spent that whole night on the border sitting up on the hill with many other people watching all this going on.
Wow.
Yeah. But I ended up having to get, they stayed in that house. And I don't know if you have heard the stories, but there was hordes of Panamanians looking for Americans. And these people were really afraid that they were going to get. So all the American contractors that were involved in our company had come to this one house. And I ended up getting a Panamanian permission from the Panamanian Guardia. They got some trucks, and we went in there and brought them out and brought them back in the Canal Zone and put them up in the Tivoli Hotel. Mm-hmm. And one of the events that happened, when we checked them into the hotel, I went out and I was inside the hotel, but looking out of the hotel down the steps of the old Tivoli Hotel, and a soldier got shot right there. Mm. A shot came from over in Panama City, and he had just stepped out of a truck and got shot there. So those were exciting days.
Yeah. What were the, serving there, I recall, of course, I was there in the mid-80s, and I just, So people have asked me about the kinds of relationships that we had with civilians, and I just don't remember having much contact. When you were there, I mean, the other side, did you have much contact with the military, with U.S. military?
Well, the Canal Zone people and the military people were very close. And I have so many friends that were in the military there, mm-hmm. That I still keep up with. But it's through the things that you do. So I made a lot of these friends through golf. You follow me?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I've heard a lot of military guys say, well, I was treated bad down there by the Canal Zone people. In fact, when I was in high school, if a girl dated a soldier, she was called rat bait, things like that. But, wow. You know, it's these things happen back in the United States, too. It's just,
sure,
it's the way people are. But where I live now, I live in Sun City here in Florida, and I've got 5 friends over there that were in the military, and I didn't know them down there, and they talk very highly of the times that they lived there and the relationships they had. One guy married a nurse. He was a sergeant in the Army down there, and he married a nurse at Gorgas Hospital. And they, you know, and there are many of the girls that grew up in the Canal Zone ended up marrying military guys. And here at this reunion that's going on now, there's a lot of them that were married, you know, that way.
Yeah.
So it was, but I don't know. There were a lot of good relationships and a lot of poor relationships, but that's, you'll find that any place.
Any place, yeah. Well, now, between the time of the 40s and maybe, you know, through the 70s, what types of changes did you see in the Canal Zone and even in the broader region?
Well, like I told you, I graduated in 56, and we were still, well, I'll tell you, they changed over the electrical. They went from 25 cycle to 60 cycle, and that was a big move. And then television came in. Now, I never had a television. I never saw a television. It wasn't in until after I graduated from high school. Air conditioning was the biggest thing that I think that ever happened down there. I can remember that was the greatest thing that ever happened. Gee. But you know, we lost the canal did away with the ships that they operated. It went back and forth to, at that time they were going back and forth to New Orleans, and people started flying back to the United States when they returned. And little by little, like the rest of the world, everything, technology changed and things became different. One of the interesting things in growing up is your shoes would grow green mold overnight in the house. Mm-hmm. You know, Panama is very tropical.
Yeah.
And we all used to stuff newspaper into our shoes. And it's just anything that got wet got moldy.
Yeah.
But the air conditioning changed everything. But they didn't have air conditioning in the school. The building was very, very hot.
Right. And what was your job like? And I'm assuming you went into, now you were managing the housing.
I came, after I transferred from the police department, I transferred into housing, and I started off as what they call the assignment clerk. I assigned the houses and also ran the moving truck. I had 3 crews of movers, because people, you know, in the Canal Zone, the way you got your house, there were 2 ways to get a house. You got it through your service, I lived in my lifetime, I think I said this before, I lived in 23 different houses, but you bid on houses. Mm-hmm. And you were assigned the house by your service. Let's say a house became vacant and we advertised every week. You applied for your house and your service date was the determination of whether or not you got the house. Oh. In other words, if you had the most service of all the people that put in for that particular house, you got the house. And so people were moving all the time to get better houses. And then there was official housing. Mm-hmm. And when I became Chief Community Services, I got an official assignment, and the house I lived in was at the was three houses past the governor's house, and that was a dream come true for me because that was a big house when I was a little boy growing up. Uh-huh. That's where the big folks lived. Wow. So I had arrived in my mind, you know.
Okay.
I loved that house. Yeah, I went back to Panama a year ago. And a friend of mine was driving me around there, and I wanted to see my house up there. And it had been bought by a fellow who had a lot of money, and he took that old wooden house and must have hired a very creative architect, and he turned it, it went from just being an old wooden canal zone house to a gorgeous chalet, you know?
Wow.
Yeah. That's what money can do.
Yeah, it's hard. So what was your job title, you know, as you reached your senior position? It was...
Well, I was superintendent of housing.
Okay.
From about 75 to 85, 1975 to 1985. And I got promoted to assistant chief community services. And my last 6 months there, I was chief community services.
Okay. And housing was your main activity?
Well,
were there other activities?
As the chief community services, I had four branches under me. I had the library branch. We had a very, very top-notch library. And we also had recreation services that came under my division. Mm-hmm. We had the housing management branch. And at that time, we had slightly under 6,000 houses left. And I also had what they call the buildings management branch. We managed many of the buildings operated by the Panama Canal. And we, at one time, the division that I was chief of also had the grounds management branch. You know, as a sidebar to this, one of the things that they used to, the newspapers that were trying to convince everybody that the treaty was right, used to always put in articles about the manicured lawns in the canal zone. Yeah, the canal zone had a branch that kept all the grass cut.
Mm-hmm.
But if you didn't keep the grass cut in the tropics, you had a jungle real soon. So really, it was simple grass cutting. I live in a town, a retirement community here in Sun City. The lawns are 10 times better than any lawns were down there in the canal zone.
Okay.
But the newspapers made such a big deal with the manicured lawns in the canal zone.
What was wrong with having manicured lawns?
They were simply lawns that got cut. Oh, golly, it was a big joke. But that
was it jealousy? Were they
no? Yeah. It was trying to convince the world that the canal zone concept was colonialism.
Uh-huh.
It was the press's attack on colonialism, and canal zone was considered colonial. You know that the United States was practicing colonialism in the canal zone,
mm-hmm.
And so they based their argument on making this type of treaty on the fact that the United States didn't want to be colonialistic.
Uh-huh.
And that's my opinion, of course.
Okay.
But that's what the newspapers were doing. the Washington Post and all the newspapers, New York Times, they were constantly bombarding the people that lived in the Canal Zone with the fact that they lived in manicured houses with manicured lawns.
Wow.
Big deal.
Yeah, I thought that was a positive thing. But, Now, you mentioned the treaty and trying to, you were part of an effort or an initiative to negotiate a different kind of treaty. What were your goals?
Well,
what were you trying to?
We simply didn't feel the United States needed to give up operational control of the canal. Look, the canal had been operated all these years in the best interest of worldwide commerce. They kept the rates down. It was well operated. We felt that, yes, some of these things, hire more Panamanians, and which had, we'd been doing that anyway, but they needed to be more Panamanians hired. But the United States, there was nothing wrong with the United States operating the canal. It didn't have to be operated in the, well, I don't know how to say this. The appearance of the canal zone concept had the appearance of colonialism, even though we could prove it wasn't a colonialistic operation, but it had all the appearance of that. Mm-hmm. We had communities that were segregated, mm-hmm. not by color, but by citizenship. They called them the silver and gold communities at one time. They were referred to as that, the Panamanian employees. And these communities that had the Panamanian employees were originally made up of the people that were imported into the canal zone to build the canal. They were the Jamaicans and the Barbadians and all of those people that came out of the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. These were the houses that the canal built to house these people. And then as these people married Panamanian people, they became integrated into the canal, into the Panamanian the Panamanian way of doing things.
Yeah.
So these towns were not originally meant for Panamanians. They were meant for the imported laborers. Mm-hmm. But the it seemed as time went on, as these people became Panamanian citizens and all that, that we were segregating the communities by citizenship, you know, and color. Because let's face it, most of the people that were imported to do the work on the canal were the black people out of the Caribbean. Although there were many, many Italians that were brought in, Chinese people were brought in, mm-hmm. and many of the Chinese people went on to become Panamanian citizens and became very, very wealthy people in commerce in Panama. Mm-hmm. You know, Hindus. There were Hindus that came to work.
Mm-hmm.
There were people brought to the canal zone from all over the world to build the canal. It wasn't just Americans.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, you know, they talk about the thousands and thousands of people that died in the construction of the canal. Only 300 were Americans that died.
Mm.
People don't realize that factor. Mm. My grandfather happened to be one of those 300 that died.
Yeah.
But most of the people that died were the black Jamaican people, you know? They get the landslides in the construction of the canal, dynamite accidents. It was... For political purposes, they tried to make the American canal zone people look bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wrong of them to do that. You know, so many of the canal zone people had like I told you before, married Panamanian girls and what have you.
Yeah.
They probably at the time the canal zone was turned over in 99 to the Panamanians, most of the people that were still down there, I would say more than half of them were half Panamanian, half American, you know? It had gradually changed over where it was a mixture. It wasn't just all white American people.
It was changing.
It was changing. Constantly changing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Whereas people maybe in the, I don't know, the media, or I'm still trying to get a handle on this, people from the outside, say people in the United States, appears as if they didn't see the changes occurring.
They didn't want to see it. They didn't. They knew the truth.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of committees that came down here and did research, and the way the truth was perverted by a lot of these things, newspapers, on they twisted the facts on so many things.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you the truth. I was sick at my stomach most of the time. Mm-hmm. I did an interview like we're doing here with the Saturday evening, the Washington Post, and I asked them to retract some of the things they said. They absolutely twisted what was said.
What you said?
Yeah, what I said. Twisted it.
Uh-huh.
I never got a reply from them. But, you know, once something goes to press like that, you're not going to change it. People read that stuff.
Yeah.
But I think Panama has done a pretty good job of operating the canal. We the last 20 years, the canal, you know, from the point the treaty was signed, we were forced into promoting Panamanians and hiring Panamanians in, like, in the trade groups and going through the schools that the canal operated to become electricians and plumbers and things like that. It was almost all Panamanians put into those jobs. So little by little, even though it was still the canal zone, it was becoming more and more Panamanians. And they've done a fairly good job of it. I think most of us were really concerned with the fact that notoriously the Panamanian government had the politicians, like we're seeing in the United States, the politicians, you'd become president and you'd take all you could get, and the people around you take all you get. We saw that happening if they took over. In fact, the Panamanians saw the same thing. Many of my Panamanian friends said, oh, they're going to take all the money and steal it from the canal. Well, they've done a pretty good job of not doing that. I don't know. I can't tell you the inside story now because I'm not involved with it.
Yeah.
But I think they set up a way of managing it that prevented a lot of that from happening. But the canal zone people, based on history of the way Panama had operated, were afraid that this was going to happen. But I'll make this remark. The cost of a ship going through the canal is far greater than it ever was. And that's affected world commerce, you know, and the cost of goods of the United States far more than people realize.
Yeah, there's the widening that's on the
horizon. Well, they also said the canal was antiquated and they didn't need it. And here they give them $7 billion to widen it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. That was interesting. Well, I know I've taken a lot of your time, Mr. Deslandes.
Well, I enjoyed it.
But you went back. You mentioned that you went back.
A
year ago. What were your impressions? I mean, what were your feelings going back? I mean, when you left, or you think, this is it, I'm leaving this behind. But you, what were your...
Well... The canal zone is no longer what I knew growing up. It was one of the most beautiful little places you've ever seen. It was a fabulous place. But it has changed. The world has changed. There's so much traffic in the old town of Balboa now. You've been down there. You wouldn't recognize it. I mean, I didn't even know where I was going most of the time. There's so many different streets now. It's become industrialized. It's a changing place. Well, I think it's not what I knew.
Yeah.
But who cares what I knew, you know? I grew up in what I consider one of the greatest places in the world. It was fun to live in the Canal Zone as a kid. You know, it was a great place to be. It's now just it's a big business.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big, big business. That's the difference. I don't know if I've helped you on any of this.
Been fabulous. And this is the difference between oral history and journalism. I mean, we're not going to be changing your words. It's the final text. Were there any final thoughts you had, the things we didn't talk about that you'd like to add?
Well, I could go on and tell story after story, you know, but I think you've got enough there that different light on it than you've heard before.
It's been incredibly educational. I've learned a lot just from listening and the questions. But thank you, Mr. Dislanis.
Well,
I really appreciate it.
Okay. That's okay.